This is Radio EcoShock.
Introducing our next guest on Radio EcoShock is a bit of a problem. It can take 5 minutes to list out his posts, awards, and credentials, and his time is too valuable, so I'll spare you some of that. Back in 1980, Dr. Thomas E. Lovejoy introduced the term biological diversity to the world. He's currently a professor at George Mason University and the biodiversity chair at the Heinz Center. Dr. Lovejoy has advised the United Nations, the World Bank, and three past presidents. Beyond that, though, he's a tireless advocate for endangered ecosystems that have no voice of their own. Dr. Thomas Lovejoy, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much.
Well, Thomas, it seems the environment community and the public are tightly focused on fossil fuels as the threat to the world climate. But in this fight against coal and oil, we may be missing another huge cause of climate change. Can you talk to us about that?
So it actually cuts both ways. I mean, climate change has really devastating consequences for biological diversity. But also in the biology of the planet is a partial solution to the climate change challenge we've set up for ourselves. And the little known fact is that a major portion of current excess CO2 actually comes from three centuries of ecosystem destruction and degradation. And it would be possible through ecosystem restoration, if done at planetary scale, to actually take back about half a degree worth of potential global warming. So there's some good news built into all of this.
So what are we talking about? Are we talking about forests disappearing or what?
So in terms of how that excess CO2 arrived in the atmosphere, it's from deforestation and it's from essentially degrading grasslands and grazing lands. It's from forms of agriculture which leak carbon as opposed to retain it or, in fact, ideally build it up because it relates to soil fertility. So it's all about ways we have used terrestrial ecosystems, and there probably is a companion piece to that in marine systems, maybe not as much, but in terms of mangroves which have been destroyed and coastal wetlands and the like.
Yes, we have almost a club of people who are constantly pointing out the huge amount of carbon that we've lost through agriculture. It's just sort of disappearing out of the soil and up into the atmosphere.
That's right, and taking the associated fertility with it.
You've warned as climate changes, whole ecosystems don't move together, individual species move. Why is that important?
Because at a certain point, instead of sort of the mild little ripples of change that we're mostly seeing these days, although there's some really major ones, that you'll get to a point where each of these species will be moving in different directions and at different rates, and the ecosystems that we know will disassemble, and then whatever species manage to survive will reassemble into ecosystems that are really hard to envision in advance and certainly to manage for.
Well, you are known, Thomas Lovejoy, for your work on the Amazon, but I want to ask you about an area of the world that's less talked about, namely the African savanna. What is happening there? What are the challenges?
The African savanna, shockingly, is now down to about 30% in intact form. So all those great animals of the African savannas are all, in one degree or another, endangered in the process. And as agriculture advances in Africa and the population grows there, which it is certain to do, there will only be more pressure to take more of the savanna unless we essentially address it squarely and come up with better forms of agriculture that are more productive without leaking that soil carbon.
Well, and what about, for example, China, I'm told, is buying up a lot of farmland there to export food back to their own country, and then you have the mining. There's a lot of things going on there that we have to watch out for.
Well, that's precisely the case. So it's not only agriculture and the needs of a growing population, or shall I say not particularly productive agriculture and the needs of a growing population, but it's also the interest in the natural resources of Africa that is being acted on by acquisition of major pieces of territory.
Would you allow me one tough question? I have to be frank, some of our listeners may distrust a person who has advised the United Nations or the World Bank, and even George Mason University was a little bit tarnished by the Wegman Report controversy, yet I still hear you trying as an activist, a real environmentalist. How do you personally survive the inertia of these big institutions and even the conferences that you attend that don't have a great record of stopping the destruction of the living world?
So they're essentially two answers to that. I mean, one is, in fact, those institutions are changing. And in fact, I had an hour with the president of the World Bank, essentially one-on-one on Friday, talking about biodiversity and climate change. And I can assure you that he gets this really seriously. We have a new president at George Mason, who's the world leader in sustainability for business and management schools. So a partial answer is the institutions themselves are changing. Is it all at scale yet? No. And the one thing you can guarantee is that if you don't keep trying, it will all turn out to be as awful as you thought it might be. So you just really have to keep going at it. And I did, in fact, on the 22nd of January, write a pretty strong opinion piece which ran in the Herald Tribune to the effect that, you know, this is not about business as usual. That, in fact, the kinds of things that people discuss at meetings like Davos will, in retrospect, seem trivial compared to these big, overwhelming environmental vectors.
Right. I talked to Dr. Paul Ehrlich a couple of weeks ago. He's published a paper in the Royal Society saying that the chances of the collapse of the industrial system are quite high. And he said, well, look, maybe there's only a 10% chance that we're going to get out of this in a good shape, but I'm going to keep working to make it 11%. Is that sort of your feeling on that?
Well, absolutely. I mean, if you don't work to change it for the better, it all becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with the eminent spokesman for living things, Dr. Thomas Lovejoy. Thomas, just out in the news, Bolivia is preparing to pass legislation that would give Mother Earth, actually Mother Nature, rights equal to human rights. What do you think about that?
So, in fact, they are not the first. Ecuador has a constitution that gives nature basic rights. You know, as a recognition in principle of the importance of the natural world in its own right, and also as, in the end, the fundamental resources in support of humanity, it's a smart thing to do.
Well, you know, this is something that frustrates me, even on my own program. When I talk to some good people, say, about the rainforest, they'll say, well, there may be some useful medicines or chemicals waiting for us out there, but I think these wonderful plants and creatures have a right to exist just as we do. Is that your feeling?
I certainly think there is a strong moral and ethical argument that all our fellow plants and animals and other organisms with whom we share a 4 billion year common history and common ancestry need to be treated with the kind of respect we're just talking about.
Well, how can we do it? How can we get that out to the public that nature's not just a product to be used?
I think probably the most important thing is just to give young people a chance to experience the natural world, to taste its and view its wonders firsthand. And it's hard to forget that once you've had that interaction.
Well, we're going to have to make that into an app for an iPhone to do it, because that's where a lot of people are.
Here's the interesting thing. You know, I mean, I always have been a great believer in harnessing technology to do good for the environment, which is why I started the Nature series on public television 30 plus years ago. And now it turns out that John Kress at the Natural History Museum at the Smithsonian has produced an app called Leaf Snap, which basically you can go up to any tree in the mid-Atlantic or eastern United States, photograph a leaf. It will take 55 measurements and tell you what species it is.
I could have used that when I was sort of in the back to the land movement, because I moved up there and didn't know the trees by their bark, and that's what you need in the wintertime when there aren't any leaves, so you've got to recognize that to know what the good firewood is. So we have a lot to learn as city people.
That's right. Well, I'm sure that, you know, the next version of Leaf Snap will also allow you to identify trees from buds and things like that.
Well, getting back to the climate, you warn that it may not come gradually like the sloping curve on the graphs we've seen. What could happen?
I think the capacity of the climate system to have abrupt change is very real, and we know that's happened in the past. We also are already seeing abrupt change in ecosystems. For example, when tropical coral reefs have bleaching events and basically, you know, the whole technicolor world becomes black and white and the productivity and diversity crash and the benefit to local populations crash. So that's why I'm so concerned about trying to keep climate change below 1.5 degrees.
So you don't think 2 degrees is really safe?
I think 2 degrees is too much. It's a world without tropical coral reefs. It's a world without coniferous forests in western North America. It's a world probably with dieback and the southern and eastern Amazon and a whole bunch of other things that we actually can't even sort of foresee.
Would you care to get specific about a couple of species that you love but fear may become extinct?
I would flag two groups of species generally. One that live in high places, like pika in the southern Rockies, which live at high altitudes and will be tracking their changing climate by moving upward in altitude until suddenly there's no further to go. So there are a whole bunch of high altitude species around the world which are very vulnerable. And similarly, island species are quite vulnerable, especially low-lying island species, because the last time the world was 2 degrees warmer, the oceans were 4 to 6, maybe even 8 meters higher. So that's going to have a huge impact on coasts and coastal populations, and a lot of those low-lying islands and their species will just simply disappear beneath the waves.
Some biologists suggest we're already in the sixth great extinction event. Do you think that's going too far?
You know, personally, I think we can already begin to see the outlines of it, maybe dimly, but yes.
I know a lot of us accept the Earth as a physical system. We were comfortable with it that way, but you've said it's a biophysical system, so why is that important to know?
Well, if you really want to manage how the climate works, you have to take cognizance of the carbon cycle. I mean, the reality is all that excess CO2 is a product of biological activity. Some of it's ancient biological activity in the form of fossil fuels, coal, oil, and gas, and some of it is essentially modern biological activity in terms of the ecosystem destruction of the past centuries. So if you start thinking about the climate as something that is governed both by physical aspects of the planet as well as the biology of the planet, then you're thinking holistically as we struggle with how to manage this challenge.
Well, now, if you had another hour with President Obama, what would you be talking about with him?
I think I would start with 2 degrees is too much. I'm not sure that, you know, his advisors on climate have necessarily highlighted that. You know, and everybody treats it as sort of a number to be respected when, in fact, it's mostly put together by what negotiators thought might be convenient, as opposed to what would be good for the planet and for humanity. So that would be point number one. Point number two would be, let's pull half a degree out of the atmosphere by engaging in much more restorative approaches to the ecosystems of the planet. And then thirdly, I would talk about the need to have integrated planning, whether you're talking about the Mekong or the Amazon Basin, or some portion of the United States, so that in fact you can begin to manage the landscapes and waterscapes of the world in ways which are beneficial and don't essentially end in unintended, unfortunate circumstances.
Thomas Lovejoy, would you give us a glimpse of some of the current projects that you're working on?
So I'm just starting with my co-editor Lee Hanna on a second edition of Climate Change and Biodiversity, because our understanding of that topic has just exploded in the essentially 7 years since it was published. So that's one thing, and I'm still working on Amazon issues and what happens when you break a forest up into fragments. I also chair the science panel for the Global Environment Facility, which is the largest funder of environment projects in the world, at least with public funds. And I don't know, and every time I turn around, I find something more I need to do.
Well, as we wrap up, is there anything else you would like to say or leave us with?
Well, you know, more than anything, I would just say, you know, the more people help others understand both the importance of the living world and the wonders of it, the better we will contribute to our children's and grandchildren's future.
Our guest has been Dr. Thomas Lovejoy. He's one of the fathers of environmental science and a champion of nature. Dr. Lovejoy teaches at George Mason University. He's the biodiversity chair at the H. John Heinz Center for Science, Economics, and the Environment. Lovejoy is an advisor to the Global Environment Facility and much more. Find links to all that in my blog at ecoshock.info. Thomas Lovejoy, thank you for talking with us.
Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. You can help Radio EcoShock keep going. Make a donation at our website, ecoshock.org.